I think in talking to one another on the themes of democracy and politeia, whatever exactly we should understand that to mean today, it's very important to recognize when we are doing so and what is going on in the world around us. And in particular, to recognize that the huge disjunction in the functioning of the global economic system on within which we are all trying to live our lives has been bound to inflict, and certainly is inflicting, vast damage to the lives of enormous numbers of people, none of whom probably are within hearing distance of what we are saying to one another. Emboldened by Professor de Volvay's magnificently instructive paper, which I urge all of you to read carefully and think about, and in the spirit of dialogue to which we're summoned and incited, I'm going to abandon the paper which I've dutifully inserted into the e-journal and try to convey what I was up to in writing it in the first place, and then to relate that to some of what we've been saying and not saying to one another over the last 2 days. The point of dialogue is to understand others better and to clarify your own point of view by doing so. And the point of political dialogue, and it's hard to talk about politics, however monologic your own inclinations, without engaging in political dialogue, the point of political dialogue is that insofar as your own point of view survives understanding others better, perhaps also to convince them that yours has some merits which they'd be wise to try to incorporate into their own point of view with whatever modification that incorporation proves to require. I'm going to begin from something said a long time ago by a now dead friend, the British philosopher Bernard Williams. It was the opening sentence of the chapter he contributed on philosophy to a book with the now deeply unfashionable title, The Legacy of Ancient Greece, though I suppose the legacy of ancient Greece is what we've actually all been talking to one another about for the last 2 days. That sentence read, "The legacy of ancient Greece to modern philosophy is modern philosophy." Now, I guess how you hear that depends a bit on how you feel about modern philosophy. But in any case, the question I want to address now is just what is the legacy of ancient Greece to modern politics? How you choose to answer that question, no doubt, also depends on how you feel about modern politics. But I certainly don't think it should depend just on anything of that kind. It's quite a straight question, and no straight answer to a straight question of practical judgment should simply rest on a structure of sentiments or imaginative habits. One must distinguish the question of what people are likely to say from what they have good reason to believe. Now, the clearest and most obtrusive legacy of ancient Greece to modern politics is the presence of a single Greek word as the mandatory frame through which to orientate ourselves politically across much of the world. You can see the nature of that legacy a lot of different ways, and Josh Ober has just given us a very carefully worked through and very engaging reading of one way in which to do so. But I see it, I'm afraid, quite a lot more despondently. And here's why. If democracy, or insofar as democracy, is the legacy of ancient Greece to modern politics, it's reasonable to fear that what it principally and most consequentially offers us is a certain blurrily celebratory light which it casts on the regime form in and under which we mostly now live. No one who's spoken so far in this dialogue, and I guess probably not very many who are listening to it, was audibly living now in a country with a different regime form, wherever they came from initially. So just why is that light so blurry? I think mainly because democracy and contemporary political speech equivocates incessantly and quite uncontrollably between a regime name and a normative criterion for the basis on which decisions, which consequentially affect many human beings, should in fact be being taken. As regime forms have gone over time, our form has some definite advantages. And as a basis on which to take binding public decisions, majority sanction also has some definite merits. It can clash with a great many other normative intuitions, but if you have to go with one single criterion, it's better than an equally salient alternative. But the trouble with the equivocation that's built into the term democracy in contemporary political speech is that that normative criterion has a pretty distant and ethereal connection with the way any bit of the world in which we live is actually organized. So we certainly shouldn't hear its relation to our own way of life as celebratory at all. We like to think that our regime form is a reliable framework for organizing our collective life, and perhaps that part of its reliability comes from its pretty metaphorical connection with the correct normative criterion for taking public decisions, and hence both that it constitutes a substantial contribution to our regime's reliability and an appropriate symbol for its real and deeply appropriate commitments. But I'm afraid none of those presumptions is actually warranted. I'm sure that the political spirit in which to confront the current crisis is the one which Professor De Volve conjures up in his paper, one of purposefully confident civic engagement. Perhaps Ancien Régime France's finest legacy to modern politics. But that doesn't help with the firmly cognitive task of understanding the nature and implications of the current crisis. Optimism may be a civic virtue, but it's not a cognitive strength or merit. Cognitively, you shouldn't be optimistic or pessimistic. What you need to be is right. So what has the crisis shown so far about this distant linguistic echo from ancient Greece and its place in organizing or naming the organization of our lives? I'd say principally how little we really comprehend about the ecology within which all of us are now living, how poorly we judge the relation between the dynamics of economic booms, the structuring of credit markets and international trade, and how comprehensively we can bemuse ourselves about the basis on which we are all living and about our capacity to protect and adjust that basis for the better through our own political choices. Every long boom ends in a fool's paradise. In every subsequent crash, hundreds of millions of lives, and perhaps in future, thousands of millions of lives, fall to pieces. We don't have a model of that kind. 3.5 centuries after the scientific revolution, and quite a long way into the intellectual history of the social sciences and modern government. And perhaps we just aren't ever going to acquire one. I don't know we aren't, of course, but you assuredly don't know that we are. Now, the ingratiating element of the modern representative democratic regime, that's the source of democracy's remarkable global strength in competition with other rival regime forms. That's why it has driven monarchy and aristocracy, as regime names at least, so largely from the field. There aren't really any residual self-professed aristocracies as forms of government in the world any longer. I guess you might say the closest candidate today would be Iran, in fact. And although there certainly are still monarchies, all of these are pretty nervous about their long-run prospects, and I wouldn't personally assign encouraging actuarial odds to any of them, even in the medium term. As a regime title, democracy has Darwinian survival advantages. But what isn't so clear is what survival advantages in the longer run it possesses as a real regime form. What role will political equality play in deciding what those advantages are or aren't? That's the question I wanted to raise in the paper I submitted. What exactly does our regime promise as political equality, and how far does it deliver on that promise? It certainly doesn't, and very obviously doesn't, deliver equality in power. There couldn't conceivably be equality in power, even in one country, in a comprehensively capitalist world, any more than there can be or is equality between the citizens of different countries. We live within a system which has great merits in comparison with the myriad of other smaller systems which it has erased from the globe. And that's in large part why it has erased them from the globe. But no sane person could mistake it for a split second for a system which favors or even permits equality of power, either in one country or between the citizens of different countries. In our societies, as in every human society there's ever been, we're manifestly unequal, not merely in power, but also in judgment. Some of us, regrettably, are complete idiots, so much for equality of respect as a political category. And almost none of us dispose of, or of anything which many of their fellow citizens could readily mistake for wisdom. That's how the human condition still is and how it always has been. If you accept genetics, as you must in your own case at least, and if you subscribe to free agency, which most of us appear to, that's how it's going to remain. Could anyone mistake our societies as ones in which the citizens enjoy or suffer from an equality in voice? Is my voice equal to Rupert Murdoch's, or my Italian friend's voices equal to that of Silvio Berlusconi, whether or not he happens to be Prime Minister at the time? The offer of political equality in the slender, last instance, ultra-marginal form of the vote is the great comparative advantage of our regime form. But how very little it guarantees, and how grossly inadequate that slender guarantee will always be for mastering the hurricanes in which we will continue to be caught up and which may batter any of our lives to pieces. and certainly are battering the lives of enormous numbers of people to pieces at the moment. So what should we take from those very ancient Greeks for our own political lives? What's the legacy we should ask for and accept? We certainly shouldn't repudiate the charismatic word they've somewhat inadvertently handed down to us, but we must recognize how dismally little that word has to do with the practical organization of our lives, and how grimly narrow the human range it took in, even in Athens itself, with its confidently surly slaves all those centuries ago. The one thing we should state from them, whether we're democrats or aristocrats or even fantasized monarchs in our own imaginative susceptibilities, is something else which we need with very great urgency in the era of spuriously democratic illusion in which we are all plunged. It's that unblinking radical commitment to think hard and focus what thought shows, logos if you like, which the Greeks did generate and explore with such astonishing energy so very long ago. Kant's slogan, the patron saint of the project of moral imagination, which Josh was expounding to us so splendidly. Kant's slogan, dare to know, of course, was a Latin, not a Greek formula, but I think it's historically right to hear in it a distant echo from this particular set of map coordinates very long ago. Insofar as we don't dare to know, or even dare to ask how far we do know, in the rickety vessels on which we're all embarked in the maelstrom of the contemporary world economy, my children and your children and their children's children are in for a very grim future. Democracy is not primarily an identificatory concept, an expressive facility. We must learn how to recover it as a category through which to think, and to think practically and politically and frankly together.